Molly and I were away last week celebrating our, belatedly celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary. We've been in Scotland. And those of you who know Molly will know that when we got back, one of the first things she wanted to do was to put all her photographs, all 725 of them, onto her computer. And so she set it going and came downstairs, because it's quite a slow process, and it had got to 425, and then it just shut, just stopped dead. And we didn't know why, so we started it up again. It only got to 360 the next time, and then it stopped dead. And then for the rest of the evening, every time we tried to start it, it wouldn't start at all. So next morning, I thought, well, we'll just give it a go before I ring Dennis. Dennis isn't here this morning, but those of you who know Dennis know that quite a number of us rely on Dennis when we've got computer problems. We have to ring him up and say, what do you think this might be? But before I rang him, I just prayed for it. I laid hands on it as I switched it on, and it worked. Now, I'd like to say to you, it's continued to work all the time. It hasn't. It still dies occasionally, and we don't know why. But it was one of those things where I thought to myself, actually, I have asked God. There's no really, you know, I can't prove to you, because I think there probably is a problem with it at the moment. I can't prove to you that God did something to our computer that morning. All I know is that in order to do what we want to do, God's responded. And it's pushing me forward to expect more of God. Now, during this period of time, we are in the process of looking at a whole host of Old Testament characters. And noting two things in particular. Noting, number one, that they were actually ordinary people like you and me. And therefore, there must be something for us to learn from that. Because God used them, and God forgave all sorts of things, and God pressed into all sorts of possibilities. And we're also noting on everything we look at that God is a supernatural God and always has been. Now, Sam and Colin, in the last 2 weeks, they've been looking at Moses. You could actually spend a year looking at Moses, to be honest. I want to conclude the Moses story this morning, and I'm picking it up from where Colin left it last week. And where Colin left it last week was the children of Israel were just about to leave Egypt. So the rest of the story, they're about to go into the promised land, which means I'm starting at Exodus 14, going right through Leviticus, right through Numbers, and right through Deuteronomy to the end. And I'm describing a journey that the scholars say could have been done in a fortnight and took 40 years. And my title is Fortnight, or it's actually misprinted on there. It says Fortnight of 40 Days. It's Fortnight of 40 Years. Now, I'm not going to cover all that story, don't panic. But I'm just, though I would actually encourage you to read what I've just described, because you'll find it fascinating. I'm convinced that as you read it, you'll think, oh, I'm a bit surprised at God doing that. And then you'll read other things and you'll say, oh, I'd completely forgotten that. It's a story worth reading about the man that the Bible describes as the most humble man that ever lived. That's how the Bible describes Moses. So you see, I'm coming back to my first question about how would you react if you saw this pillar, because you see, it is all about God's presence. It's all about the question, is God there or isn't he? And there's a great deal in these chapters about God's presence, not just about pillars of cloud and pillars of fire. There is much, much more. On the night of that final plague, when throughout Egypt firstborn sons were found to have died in every Egyptian household, fear filled the place. There'd been plenty of evidence that God was around over the preceding months, because all sorts of things had happened, as Colin was talking about last time. But Pharaoh and his advisors had managed to dismiss most of these. They somehow hadn't been permanently and ultimately affected. But this was the limit. When eldest sons began to die, he called Moses and says, okay, I give in. Take your people out there to worship your God. Take everything that's yours. And he even asked that they would bless him in their prayers. And the Egyptian people likewise, they said, go quickly, because they were fearful that it wouldn't stop at eldest sons, that they would all die. And in fact, they were asked by the Israelites for gifts to take with them. And they gladly gave. Some scholars say that they virtually bankrupted Egypt in all that was given to them as they departed. It was huge. As you read the rest of the story, you realize that these slaves later on are giving and giving and giving for the building of the tabernacle. Where did it all come from? It had to come from Egypt because they had nothing else. So you've got, and even if you read it, even as they're leaving Egypt, God is giving them instructions about recalling this event in years to come. They're given instructions as they go, saying, remember this, remember this. And, well, you can imagine it's not very long before Pharaoh regrets his decision, because he's just seen all of their slaves disappear. Whole host of the wealth of Egypt gone with them. And he's recovered now. He's thinking, hey, I can't allow this to happen. And fear, this time, strikes the Israelites. But Moses says, do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. And that's exactly what they did see. The cloud stood between them overnight. And from the Egyptian side, it was deep blackness. They could see nothing. It was a huge black cloud that meant they could not see Israel at all. Whereas on the other side, Israel was in bright light in anticipation of crossing the Red Sea. And you also know that they crossed the Red Sea on totally dry land with walls of water either side of them. But when the Egyptians tried to chase them, they actually were drowned because the sea returned. And it says at the end of Exodus 14, verse 31, it says, and when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And all is well. But within 3 days, they're grumbling because they haven't found water that's drinkable. Moses throws a piece of wood into the water, which God shows him, and it becomes sweet. And again, God makes a declaration. If you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what's right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I, says the Lord, will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And within a few verses, they are thinking about returning to Egypt for lack of food. Manna is provided by God every day. It falls during the night. It's ready to collect every morning. They're given clear instructions. They're told just collect enough. Those who try to collect double so they don't have to go out the next day find it's rotten by the time they wake the second day. And yet, amazingly, on the day before the Sabbath, they are allowed to collect twice as much, and it's perfectly okay on the Sabbath day. They don't need to go. Some of them still aren't listening. Some of them still go out on the Sabbath day to look for some more, and they find there isn't any. These are people who've seen the power of God. They have seen water parted. They see pillars of cloud and fire, and they grumble and moan at every small issue. God declares his covenant. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And Peter restates that for Christians later on. The people all responded together, we will do everything the Lord has said. If only. Now, I've only gone through a few chapters so far. The next few chapters include a section where Moses up the mountain, some of the time accompanied by the other elders, all of the time by Joshua. He's given the Ten Commandments and a detailed plan for the tabernacle. That's a major tent. It's a phenomenal thing. All the details are in there. I start reading it and my eyes are boggled, partly because I don't understand what cubits are. But there are all sorts of elements to this tabernacle. It's phenomenal and it's portable. But only if you've got several pantechnicons or a barrel load of Levites to carry it. But it's amazing. And Moses has given all this detail, which is why he's up there for 40 days. God even says that he has prepared Bezalel to supervise the work, and he's equipped him with great skill, and it says, and filled him with the Spirit of God for the purpose. In other words, the man who's going to do the building is filled with the Spirit of God. Just make a quick mental note that people who do practical things still need to be filled with the Spirit of God to do what they're called to do. Now, despite all the promises, despite, I read it a few lines back, we will do everything the Lord has said, But when Moses is up the mountain for 40 days, it's too much for them. The people criticize him in his absence. I must be careful never to go away for 40 days, John. And then persuade Aaron to make a golden calf, which they declare as their God who's brought them out of Egypt. Because they've got loads of gold, because the Egyptians gave them it. So they make this calf, and they declare that that's what's brought them out of Egypt. Aaron caved in a bit. If you look at carefully, Aaron's trying to please both sides. He tries to pray as though he's praying to God at the same time as the calf, if you read it. But basically he messes up. Now, listen to the conversation that goes on at the top of the mountain between God and Moses. This is in Exodus 32. God tells Moses, he says, "Go down, because your people, whom you have brought up out of Egypt, have become corrupt." It's interesting the way God phrases it. I think it might be significant. God doesn't say, "My people, who I've brought out." He says to Moses, "Your people, who you've brought out, are corrupt." In fact, he says to Moses, he's going to wipe the lot out, and he's going to start again with Moses. Now, Moses' words at this point are fascinating, because essentially, Moses pleads their cause. And I would imagine he's had enough, really. But he pleads their cause. He says to God, "God, just remember, everybody in the world has seen you bring these people out of Egypt. What are they going to think if you just wipe the lot out now you've got them out? And what about your promise to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, which is being fulfilled by these people? You can't do it, God." And it says, God relents and decides he will forgive them. So Moses, who could have had it all his own way, pleads their cause. As he reaches the bottom of the mountain, mind you, he does get a bit worked up. He throws down the two tablets of stone that the commandments have been written on by God. And God's displeasure is declared in no uncertain terms. And in fact, punishment starts straight away in various forms. Moses speaks to the people declaring their sin. And then again he speaks to God on their behalf, asking for forgiveness. This is a significant man. Now, I just want to focus my main attention on Exodus 33 and 34. It doesn't tell you the whole story, but it's really significant in looking at what Moses was like. This is after the Lord has struck some people with a plague, and Moses has said, "Please forgive them," and it has stopped. And at the beginning of Exodus 33, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt,'" they're still his, "'and go up to the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I will send an angel before you and drive out the Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites and Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey.'" But then listen to this: "'But I will not go with you, because you are a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way.'" Now, I hadn't noticed earlier on that it said, did you notice how quickly I read by, "I will send an angel before you"? You read that and you just go, yeah, he's going to send an angel before them just to guide them. And then you get to the point where it says, God says, "I will not go with you, because if I do, I'm likely to wipe you out." Now, I can't remember the circumstances, but I remember reading that some years ago, and I was in tears instantly. You see, there are times when I'm thinking, you don't know, because I've mentioned it several times, that Dwayne White, amongst others in fact, has prophesied that the things we put in place, the things we decide, the things we anticipate, the things we declare in the first 4 months of this year will determine the next 10 years. Now, for some of you as individuals, you're looking at that and you're saying, the next 10 years, that's a significant chunk of time. And some of the decisions we made, I'm looking at it, ground level, conference starts tomorrow, and we are making some quite significant changes that are set in place to determine what happens in the next 10 years. And as far as Ashwood's concerned, we heard that word a bit late. But I tell you, as leaders, we have been seriously asking God what we should be doing what we should be putting in place, what changes God wants to make so that we are ready for what he wants to do in the next 10 years. Now, these things are difficult. How do you handle these sorts of things? And we are trying to do our best. So as leaders, we start, first of all, sharing the things that we feel we're hearing from God. Then we are in the process of talking to the small group leaders so that they understand where we think we should go. And on, I think, is it the 13th, 15th of July? It's the 13th on a Sunday. It's June, sorry. On a Sunday morning, we hope by then to be able to bring to you a bit of shape of where we believe we should change certain things to move ahead for the next 10 years. And have you noticed this morning, I jotted some things down as this meeting did it, and I listened to your meeting last week. Molly and I were in Scotland. We were actually on the Isle of Iona when you were meeting, I believe, or perhaps we were on a boat getting there. But I listened to it, and I listened to different things being said by different people. And I noticed again this morning, I noticed Martin, for instance, instead of pressing straight on with what he decided, he kept praying. He kept reading a bit of Bible, even a UCB book about parrots. And then I'm listening to the different things that are happening. And I am aware that in amongst us, there are things stirring within you. Somebody prayed this morning about Kirkby. And Molly had to put Ravenshead in because she is always stirred about what God's going to do in Ravenshead. Now, we haven't seen clear what it's going to be, but we do believe we've still got a share in that. And actually, it's great to welcome a couple of friends of Derek Norwich from Shirebrook and from the church up there, because I sense that in the next 10 years, there'll be more and more connection between us and certain churches for the sake of the kingdom. I mean, I'd like to say you can have Derek Norwich, but you can't. But I believe one of the reasons is because there is something that God has said to them about being here and drawing something from here. And that's no disrespect to you, it's just what God's doing, that equips them to do what he wants them to do. And so, but I'm aware that some of you have got burden. Now, sometimes you therefore find you're thinking, I mean, even this morning you're thinking, now, if I were leading this meeting, I wouldn't do that. Or you're thinking, why are we focusing our prayers on that? I'm more concerned about this. Now, don't worry about it. But whatever you do, don't automatically assume that whoever's doing the rest is wrong. Because there will be a whole lot of different things going on. Because God is going to stir individual passions up within you that are a part of the big picture, but don't mean that the whole church has to go there with you. Because the church is bigger than you think. And we are trying to do things that are far bigger than we're really capable of doing. And that's why some people, so you see Martin and Susan still with us, rightly so, but if you press them, they've got a burden for something. They believe God put them there for a reason. But when they go and test out to see if they should be there, they come back thinking, no, actually, we're still supposed to be here. Now, I don't know how that's going to work out, but I endorse their burden for Sutton, because there is something that we will be called to do eventually during this next 10 years that will support what they want to see happen. I don't know what yet. But do you see the point I'm making? So therefore, some of you are getting really stirred up about different things and you think, this church isn't concerned about this. Well, if you are, this church is. Because the church cannot be concerned about every single issue that God lays hands on someone's individual heart. But what we can do is we can encourage, we can pray, we can support. So when John is wandering the world, as he does from time to time, it doesn't mean that when he's gone to India, this church suddenly has a mighty burden for India, and that's where our whole attention goes. No, but what it does mean is that this church continues to support and pray for John so that he can do in India what God's called him to do, and wherever else for that matter. Do you see what I mean? And it's fascinating. The story, I have read that book several times and I didn't even remember that story. But isn't it fascinating that when you ask God for something, he then begins to channel you in a direction that you hadn't thought of? Because, you know, sometimes we have these big prayers. God, will you save Africa? Well, God's in the process of doing it, but he doesn't do it by a big thunderclap or even a volcano. He does it by taking an individual person and putting them into amazing places. And you and I can be those individual people in doing amazing things in ordinary places. Because Moses was a man who said, well, I really can't do it. If it's all the same with you, God, would you send someone else? And God said, no, you're going. I'll send Aaron to do the talking for you if you like, but you're going. And go he did. So that's just a bit of extra for you. I'll read on in chapter 33, because, as I said, if God were ever to say to me about where we're going, but I'll not go with you, because this is a stiff-necked people. You're not a stiff-necked people, are you? Good. Now, when the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments, for the Lord had said to Moses, tell the Israelites you're a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you even for a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments and I will decide what to do with you. So they took off their ornaments and they stood meekly before God at Mount Horeb. And then it just gives us a little bit of insight. It says, let me just make sure I'm not missing anything, because there are one or two important things here. No, I'll read on. Verse 7 in the same chapter says, now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. The tent of him meeting God. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrance to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. And as Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance to his tent. And the Lord would speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, didn't leave the tent. We shall look at Joshua in a couple of weeks. Joshua's always in that tent. Joshua's preparation is phenomenal, because he's always with God. Now, you would find it easier, wouldn't you, if every time I was seeking direction from God for Ashwood Church, you were able to watch a pillar of cloud outside the door at 62 Swinton Rise. It would help you, wouldn't it? Because sometimes you think, what on earth is he doing now? And I do sometimes, because you see, there are those times when you think to yourself, I think I've heard God, but I'm not 100% sure. And then somebody will say, well, I don't think that's quite right, Graham. That sounds risky. That'll cost too much. That'll upset so-and-so, whatever it might be. And when you read this story, it does put you off a bit when you realise they're grumbling every few minutes despite pillars of cloud. Fortunately, I don't think you are a grumbling people to any great extent, are you? Reading on, listen to this. Moses, now Moses, he has some incredible conversations with God, you know. It says, Moses said to the Lord, you've been telling me, lead these people, but you haven't let me know whom you will send with me. In other words, he's dismissing this angel as being unsatisfactory. You have said, I know you by name and I have found favour. And you've found favour with me. If you are pleased with me, says Moses to God, teach me your ways so I may know you and continue to find favour with you. Remember that this nation is your people, he says to God. Because remember, God keeps saying it's yours. Moses said, remember, it's yours. I mean, this is cheeky, isn't it? You know, I mean, I can say, I think Gay would have that kind of conversation with God. I can just imagine that. But for some of us, you know, it just seems a little cheeky, doesn't it? Remember, God, they're yours. Well, I mean, if I was in his position, I'd definitely be saying that. I wouldn't want him saying the mine. And then, this is what the Lord says to him. The Lord replied, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Moses isn't settled there. He says, then Moses said to him, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't send us. Why? Well, how will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth. That's what's distinguishing God's people. God's with us. That distinguishes God's people. And we don't ever want to be in a place where God's not with us, do we? And so it's absolutely vital. And then the Lord says to Moses, I will do the very thing you've asked, because I am pleased with you, and I know you by name. Then Moses said, then show me your glory. And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you can't see my face, because no one can see my face and live. Then the Lord said, there's a place near me where you may stand on a rock. And when my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft in the rock and cover you with my hand until I've passed by. And then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. Phenomenal. Marvellous stuff. Conversations like that are quite incredible, aren't they? Now, just in case you think I've only got bad news about the Israelites, if you read on a chapter into chapter 35, it's worth just having a look here, because Moses calls for an offering. He wants an offering of two things. He wants an offering of fine things, because that's to make this tabernacle. If you read Exodus, you'll find a complete picture of the tabernacle, the altar and everything. It's there twice. Once when Moses hears it at the top of the mountain, and the second time when they're actually building it. And he says, bring me an offering to the people, because we need an offering to prepare for building this tabernacle. And he also says, and also he wants volunteers to do the work. So there are two things. There's bringing an offering, but there's also bringing what you can give in terms of skill or ability or willingness. And in the next chapter, this is what I just felt you ought to hear, just so that I can put a slightly positive spin on this group of people. It says, in the people continued to bring freewill offerings morning after morning, until eventually Moses was told that the people are bringing more than enough for the work. And so we read, and so the people were restrained from bringing more, because what they already had was more than enough to do all the work. I need to declare to you this morning, I am not restraining you. I am not saying to you, we have all we need to do the work. I hope the time may come, but it isn't in my immediate expectation. The tabernacle's completed, it's dedicated. We read this fantastic occasion of the dedication when it says the glory of the Lord filled the place. Moses couldn't even get in. It was just so full of God. Cloud and fire all was there. Now the story goes on, and I wish I could tell you that it remains in the vein that I've just described, but it doesn't. There's more grumbling that follows. Even Aaron and Miriam are jealous of their brother. Moses is their brother. And they grumble about Moses. They grumble because God seems to talk to Moses and not to them. And it's that point where the Bible says that Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone on the face of the earth. And actually, even Moses slips up on one occasion. One of these occasions when the people are complaining about a lack of water, God says to him, take your staff, very useful Moses' staff, it did all sorts of things. I didn't mention that time when half a chapter there's a battle going on, and whenever he holds the staff up, Joshua and the army down below win, and when it begins to sag, they start to lose. So he's got Aaron on one side of him, Hur on the other. They stick a rock underneath him and they hold his arms up just to make sure it stays there. And that rock, on previous occasions, struck the rock and water came out. On this occasion, God actually said to Moses, take your staff and speak to the rock. Now he lost it a bit. I don't know whether he remembered that last time it worked well when he struck it, whether he's just a bit angry, whether he didn't hear what God said. I'm not making excuses for him. This is what he said to the people. He said, listen, you rebels, must we bring water out of this rock? And then angrily he strikes the rock twice. And God tells him off. And God says, because you've done that, because you haven't honoured my word and me doing this, you will not enter the promised land. Bit harsh? Feels a bit harsh, doesn't it? But do you notice, when God's wanting to punish the children of Israel, Moses speaks up for them. And Moses says, please don't do that, God. Forgive them. When God says that to Moses, you will not find anywhere Moses ever complained. He never said, change your mind, God. He just accepted it. And there comes a day when he was taken up on the top of a mountain by God, end of Deuteronomy, and he saw the promised land from a distance, and nobody knows where he was buried, because he went up there with God and he never came back. But he never complained. I've no time to go into the happenings when spies are sent into the land, and although they recognise the land flowing with milk and honey, you'll remember the giants receive more attention than the wonderful produce. And the people again contemplate giving up on Moses and going back. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? And then Caleb and Joshua, two of the spies, they're clear that if God says this is the place, then they can go in. But the people don't listen to those two. The rebellion causes God to say that none of that generation will be allowed into the promised land except Caleb and Joshua. And when we look at Caleb in a few weeks' time, you'll hear a bit more of that story. But that's my title, you see. Fortnight or 40 years. Because it was 40 years before that generation died out, and therefore it was 40 years before God took them into the wilderness. So, a few quick lessons to be learned. What about Moses? Well, we remember from a couple of weeks ago that Moses was the reluctant hero. He didn't think he could do it. Just make a note of that. When you're saying, oh, I don't think I can do that, just think of Moses. Notice his declared humility. In other words, although God was a bit cross with him and sent him, nevertheless, he is always declared as a humble man. He wasn't dodging the issue, he was genuinely a humble man. Notice his human frailty emerges occasionally, and we've got that outburst that I've just mentioned. But much more importantly, notice the times he is willing to sacrifice all for the sake of fulfilling the plan. He speaks up and asks God to forgive, even when the possibility of promotion was before him and he could have been the answer, but no, he won't do it that way. And notice how important the presence of God is to him. He is so often in God's presence, but it matters so much that he says, if you're not going with us, I don't want to go. What about the people? What can we learn from the people? Well, we can't but notice that these people had so much given to them and they constantly grumbled. So next time you catch yourself grumbling, criticising, moaning, just remember, you may not have seen a pillar of cloud, but actually you've seen a great deal, and God is for you, not against you. They had these signs of the presence of God, yet they still rebelled. They'd been rescued from slavery, but the small problems that arose caused them to seriously consider going back. Don't do that. Don't consider going back. I mean, anybody who promises you that walking the Christian life is an instant doddle, they're not telling the truth. It's not the real thing. Walking the Christian life is not easy, and there are those times when you think, it was easier before, when I didn't have to, when I didn't need to. But don't turn back. But do notice that when an offering was called for, these people gave and gave and gave until eventually they were restrained from giving more. So, under my heading, lessons to be learned, what about you and me? Well, I think there's a warning to us that however much we see of God's goodness, we cannot assume that we do not then need to be in our guard, on our guard, that we still respond rightly to God. In fact, those times when you see God doing great things are sometimes the most dangerous. Because you suddenly think it's all automatic. And it isn't. If we see more signs and wonders, and I believe we will, I mean, Chris's story is great, isn't it? That, you know, she's taken off the list. She doesn't need a hip replacement. And actually, that's not the only story I've heard of that nature about that particular occasion. So I believe we will see more, but it doesn't mean that automatically then we'll be safe and sound and we'll never turn back. There's a great example set here by Moses, who was much more concerned about the salvation of his own people and their fulfilling their destiny than he is about the possibility of his own position being increased at their expense. I noticed from what Colin said last week, he was arguing that we must always be aware of those around us who've not yet realized their need of Jesus in their lives. It's a very important part of our own call and response to be witnesses to what Jesus has done and is doing in our lives. It really is serious stuff on our agenda. So it's not, we mustn't ever be looking down on people who are not Christians, sort of thinking they're second class. We must look at ourselves and say, actually, they're missing something vital, and we are part of the answer. We are part of the process. It's absolutely vital. And in my list, I still remember the impact it had on me when I first read of Moses' reaction when God said he would send an angel but wouldn't go with them. I remember at that time being really moved to tears at the prospect that we might choose a direction where we might have an angel with us but not God himself. I only want to go places with God himself. That's why worship in this church is so important to us, because that's our response to God's presence. I'm always looking for that sense of his presence. I'm always listening for his voice. Which is why I encouraged you a few minutes ago, and I say it again. If there are things stirring in you and you think to yourself, I think God has got this in store for me or for my friends or for us, listen to it. Seek the possibility. Get your friends around you to weigh it up with you. Don't assume that because we're doing something different, it rules it out. Because we're going to be given a lot of things over the next few weeks. And they can't all be given from the front as prophetic words. They can't all be the process for the whole church. But it doesn't mean there isn't an individual move for you. I know that God sometimes takes his time to achieve things. And that's his best way, often, rather than the instant. He often does that. We ask him for something, and years later we see the answer. And it's usually because we needed the time to adjust. And sometimes it's because we're slow. But if there is a choice, I think I prefer the fortnight route to the 40 years. What do you say?